Every now and then, I get emails about running because it's something that I like to do in my spare time. Sometimes these emails are tips and hints about technique, or they are, you know, tips and hints about what I should be eating or drinking. They are hints and tips about where I should go to buy items of clothing or equipment. But recently, I got a test, an email test, and the test basically said, you know you are a runner if, and there were a series of statements that were the kind of the test that I needed to apply to myself. I'm sure there are other similar tests for lesser sports, such as cycling or whatever, you know, you can still apply. I'm only joking, Andrew, right? And all the other cyclists that are here. But here's the test, right? Here's some questions for runners. You know you are a runner if the most expensive shoes you own are trainers. Tick, right? Okay, there we go. You know you are a runner if someone asks you what your plans are for the weekend and you respond in miles. You know you are a runner if it really irritates you when someone calls you a jogger. You know you are a runner if you know exactly where 1 mile from your front door is in any direction, because when you're on your way home, you know, I've only 1 mile to go. We apply these kind of tests all the time. Some of you will remember when, a couple of years ago, when we did the Second Half Living Project for those in their 50s and 60s, Martin Cooper, who was with us, said, you'll know you're in this second half of life, in this second stage of life, if you get electrical products mended, if you have back pain, and if you take home sachets of sugar from cafes, right? You're laughing because you do it, and you're in that stage of life. And Jesus applies a test to the followers that are sitting around the table. He gives them some things or a thing to help them know whether they're in or not, whether they're part of his community or not. He gives them a test to apply to their own lives. He makes a statement that we can all assess our own life with. What's the guarantee that someone will test positive as a disciple of Jesus Christ? Is there a watermark that we can look for inside of us? Is there a pen and a UV light that we need to be held under in order to be authenticated or not? Will someone hold us up to the light like they do on the Antiques Roadshow to see that we're really a disciple, or are we just a fake? What is the test of discipleship to establish authenticity or not? It should be no surprise to find out that there needs to be traces of love in our system if we are followers of Jesus Christ. There needs to be a trace of love in our system. It's the distinguishing mark of discipleship. If we're going to be known by the world as followers of Jesus Christ, then it boils down to love. The world will know that we are his disciples, Jesus' disciples, because of our love. It's the petri dish or the test tube where we're found out. How we relate to one another is going to be the way that people discover whether or not we are disciples, how we treat one another in the church. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. It's the test. Just before making that statement, Jesus gives us a template to follow, gives us an understanding of what love looks like, because in the previous verse, he says, as I have loved you, so you must love one another. The nature or pattern of our love for each other is shaped or molded by how he has treated us in the first place. That's the template to follow as we love one another. It's how have we been loved by him? This year at Carmoney, as we think about our identity as disciples, we're going to be thinking about how we have been loved by Jesus. We're going to spend a lot of time in this direction, going that way, thinking about that up relationship with God. How has he loved us? How has he treated us? As disciples, it's crucial to understand this. Before we attempt to go in any other direction, we need to look up and consider how God has loved us. On the 11th of September, 2001, we all watched in horror as our television screens revealed to us planes crashing into the Twin Towers in New York City. Over 3,000 people were killed, and a few were rescued, just a few rescued from the rubble. Two of those people who were rescued from the rubble were Will Jimino and John McLaughlin. They were two of the fortunate ones who were dragged from the wreckage. The reason these guys survived was because of a guy called Dave Cairns. Dave Cairns was watching on his television screen just like everybody else. He was a former Marine, watching on his television screen in work, and he left his workplace, went to the barber's, got his head shaved like it was when he was a Marine, drove home, took off his suit, got out his military fatigues, and drove at over 100 miles an hour to Manhattan. His uniform granted him access to Ground Zero, and he got right into the rubble and spent a long time digging and hunting for people in the middle of that disaster zone. Long after other rescue workers had been called off the site and ordered away, he stayed. And he was able to stay because of the clothes that he was wearing. He heard tapping on the pipes and yelling, and it was Will and John. They'd been stuck in the rubble for 9 hours by the time Dave heard them. They were trapped, unable to dig themselves out from the rubble of Ground Zero. But Will Jimino and John McLaughlin were rescued by Dave Cairns. 20 people were pulled from the rubble. Will and John were numbers 18 and 19. They're alive today because Dave Cairns took off his suit, put on the clothes of a rescue worker, and went to the danger zone. He stepped down into the darkness and mess of Ground Zero. Matt Chandler says this about this story: in the same way, but to an infinitely greater degree, God took off his royal robes, stepped into our dark and depraved culture, and served us. That's how we've been loved. When we look up, that's what we discover, that God has stepped down into our darkness. Light of the world, you step down into darkness and loved us when we were weak, when we were at our worst, unable to rescue ourselves. God loved us that way. Romans chapter 5 and verse 6 says that just the right time, when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. This is crucial for us to know as disciples, that when we were at our worst, God gave us his best. We should never forget it. We've been pulled from the wreckage of life without God, of the hopelessness of life without God. He rescued us. He took off his royal robes and dressed in the nature of a human being. He put on humanity, put on the nature of a servant, and stepped down into our dark world. He freed us from a hopeless existence and gave us life when we were unable to rescue ourselves. And this is why we worship. This is why we're glad to be in the presence of Jesus, because he is the one who has given us life. Not anything that we have done. We didn't dig our own way out. We didn't climb our own way to the top. He did it. He came down. And so we're going to be looking up this year as disciples to give thanks for the rescue that we have received. He set his love upon us when we were unable to do anything. When we forget this, we think that God loves us because we've done something. We need to position ourselves or get back into a better state. We've got to climb up some ladder and elevate ourselves so that God will be pleased with us, so that God will love us. God doesn't love you because you're lovely. He loves you because he is love. He loved us when we were powerless, when we were weak.
And we need to continually remember that. You know, if God could be manipulated by our activity, if we could force him to love us by our religious activity, he wouldn't be much of a God. If he was weak enough to be bullied into submission by your behavior and my behavior, he wouldn't be very strong, would he? Like grandparents get bullied into offering love by manipulative children. Grandparents can be wound around a finger, but not God, because he's stronger than your granny. He's more powerful than that, and we cannot manipulate him or bully him into blessing us. He loves us not because we're lovely, but because he is love. This year, as disciples of Jesus, we're going to be looking up and giving thanks for that love that is consistent. He is love, so he always loves us. Your behavior, your performance, your religious activity has no bearing on God's love for you in these moments or ever. He loves you, and we give thanks for that. We look up and worship the one who rescues us when we're at our worst, when we are powerless and weak and trapped and unable to help ourselves. That's when we are loved. He rescues us through the cross, and we give thanks for that. We look up to worship him. And as well as looking up, we're also going to look in. We're going to be thinking about our relationships with one another. When I was a youth worker, young people used to ask me all the time, do you have to go to church if you're a Christian? Like, do you have to go? If you become a Christian, do you have to go to church? And in the Alpha course, it's one of the questions that we sometimes get asked in the small group. You know what? You don't need to be, you don't need to go to church if you want to be a Christian, do you? Do you have to go to church? And I wonder what your answer would be. What would you say if someone in your workplace asked you that, or a family member asked you that? I mean, you can just be a Christian anywhere. You don't need to go to church, do you? What's the answer? How should we respond? What should you say? What does it mean to be a Christian, to follow Jesus, to love the things he loves? A Christian is a follower of Jesus, a disciple who is loved by Jesus and is following in his footsteps. If we follow the Jesus of the Bible, we're going to find it hard to absent ourselves from the local church. We're going to find it hard to step out of the local church. Not only will it be hard, it will be impossible to follow the Jesus of the Bible and not be in the local church. Because as we read our Bibles, we're encouraged to carry one another's burdens. How can you do that if you're not in the church? How can you carry one another's burdens if you are just listening to podcasts of American megachurch pastors with your headphones in your ears saying, that's great, but Michael Wiley and John Dickinson don't preach like that. That's great. You just listen to those podcasts. All that worship from that church in Australia or America is brilliant, but Dave doesn't play like that or Esther doesn't. You know, you do. Like, you're great. You're fantastic. But... But if you just absent yourself from local church and listen to mega churches and compare them to here, and we don't do as well, then you're not bearing the burdens or carrying the burdens of other people. We cannot offer hospitality to one another if we are not in the local church. If we're not actually with one another, then we cannot forgive one another, we cannot support one another, we cannot encourage one another, love one another. Someone had to forgive me this morning in the church and say, Michael, it's okay, you messed up and it's fine. I had to be forgiven because I messed up this morning because I'm in the local church. And if you're in the local church, let me tell you, you will disappoint people. I do it all the time. And so will you. In the local church, you will have the opportunity to forgive one another, to support one another. But if you're just going for a walk on the beach, or going for a walk in the forest, or going for a walk in the park and meeting God there, then who's going to carry your burdens? Who are you going to have the opportunity to support or encourage? If we're not actually with one another, then we cannot love one another like the Bible calls us to. The New Testament is really clear that disciples of Jesus should love the actual local church and its leadership. and the people sitting beside you in the pew this morning not just love the notion of church or love the idea of church and say, I really love church, and then badmouth all the other people who go to that church. That's not love for the church. We don't just love the idea of church. We love the church, the people around us, the leaders that God has placed in authority over us. How can we submit to one another if we're not actually in relationship with one another? David Watson, in his book, Discipleship, said this: God's love amongst God's people is always the most convincing argument for the truth of the gospel. And if the church is just as fragmented and divided as the neighborhood it exists in, then it has no credibility to speak to that neighborhood or culture or society. Here in Northern Ireland, we live in a divided society that's fragmented, not just in a Protestant-Catholic divide, but now there's fragmentation over racism, over economic class, and our society is so divided. And the church has an incredible opportunity to offer another way, to show a different way to relate to one another, where natural enemies love one another because what they have in common is their desperate need for Jesus. And what they don't have in common is really insignificant in comparison. Who cares that we're not in the same economic band? Who cares that our color of skin is different? What we have in common is greater because we are in desperate need of Jesus and he's rescued us. And so I have far more in common with you, even though the color of your skin is different, even though you were born in a different place, than I do with people from my own nationality who do not yet know Jesus. And so we should be united simply by loving other followers of Jesus Christ. We will draw people to him because it doesn't work like that outside the church. Jesus says, as I have loved you, so you must love one another. He doesn't love us because we're lovely. He loves us because he is love. And that's why we should love one another, not because we look at each other and think, oh, you're lovely. But because we have been loved by the one who is love, we share that kind of love with the people around us. Jesus is talking to the disciples around the table at this point, former fishermen, tax collectors, and religious extremists. They weren't a lovely bunch, but he loved them because he is love. You see, if we only love those who we deem to be lovely, we're not following in the footsteps of Jesus. We're just following in the footsteps of our culture, because people just like those who are like them. And we should be so grateful that Jesus didn't give us any preconditions in order that we had to meet so that he would love us. He just loves us as we are and longs to see us changed. And this must be the way that we love one another. And pastorates are the key way that we offer for you to be discipled, to be in relationship with one another. There are 10 groups that meet in 10 locations. They're starting this week, where you get in relationship with other people, some people who are like you, some people who are unlike you. 10 locations in Newton Abbey and Ballyclare and Temple Patrick and Belfast and Mollusc, Green Island, Jordanstown. There's loads of options for you to be in community with other people who love you and who will love Christ and will encourage you and support you. And so are you spending enough time with people that they will have the opportunity to do you wrong, and then you will have the opportunity to forgive them? Are you spending enough time with people so that they will be there when you experience illness in your own life or in your family, when you experience retirement or new birth, marriage, divorce, graduation? You know, the cycle of life and the circumstances that you find yourself in, are you in community to share those experiences with other people? See, our culture is typified by people being together but completely alone. You look at any coffee shop, loads of people together. It's a crowd, but it's not a community because they're sitting on their laptops or their iPads with their headphones in. Sure, they're together, but they are still alone. You look at anybody commuting to work, lots of people on a bus, lots of people on a train. They're in a crowd. They are together, but they're all alone. It's our culture. Together but alone. Let that not be the church, that we are together this morning, but just as alone as the world outside, we need to be in community. We need to get our headphones out and listen to one another. Love one another. Not just block out the noise and listen to whatever we like, but hear what's going on in the lives of other people. Take an interest in them because they are loved by Jesus. And share our burdens with them so that they can support us right now. Let me ask you, are you right now in a pastorate? Are you in a community where somebody can support you in a time of need? When you have the opportunity to offer forgiveness to someone or receive forgiveness, like I received forgiveness this morning. And it was great to receive forgiveness. See, if you're not in community, then you'll not experience people saying, I know you messed up, but don't worry about it. And you'll just carry your burdens by yourself. Are you in a pastorate? There's 10 options, 10 groups in a variety of locations. There's Alpha Course on a Wednesday night where there's small groups. Loads of opportunities for you to be in community with other people. If you want to be in a pastor, come and speak to me afterwards. I'll help you get connected to one that's meeting this week on a Wednesday night or a Thursday night. We need to be thinking about how we share the love of Jesus with one another. We're going to be thinking about how we look up to God and view the love that He has for us this year. We're going to share that love with one another as we look in, but we're also going to look out, and just really quickly and finally, we're going to look out to the world outside. See, we want to try and show the world outside the love that God has for that world, not just the church, but the world outside, to those who do not yet know Him. On the bins in the parks in Newton Abbey, there is this message: mess up, clean up. So if you go to any park, you'll probably see that message on a bin, and it kind of makes sense. It's the sort of thing we say to our children. Now, you made a mess, you need to tidy up these toys, you need to tidy up your room, you made a mess, tidy it up. It makes sense. It's the kind of thing a school teacher says. It's the kind of thing we all say if you're involved in youth work, you know, who made this mess, sort it out, tidy it up. We tell people to tidy up the mess that they've made. We give off when people get up from a table and leave a mess behind them. Mess up, clean up, it's logical. But it's not the message of the gospel to a broken, messy world. Thank God that it is not our responsibility to clean up the mess. The good news to messed up people in the church and in the world and everywhere is that though your sins are scarlet, they shall be white as snow. That though we are a mess, there is one who cleans it up, and it's not us. There is a Redeemer, and it's not us. His name is Jesus. We don't shake our heads in disgust at the outside world and say, it's a mess, they need to sort themselves out. We go to that world with hope and with confidence in the only one who has the ability to clean it up. And this discussion between the disciples and Jesus took place right after He'd washed their feet, right after He'd put a towel around His waist and washed their feet, as a hint or demonstration of how low He was willing to go in order to make them clean. That was the pathway to the cross, that He got down on His knees and washed their feet to say, this is what I'm about. This is the kind of God I am. This is the kind of Savior that I am. See, Jesus didn't love them because they were lovely. Their feet were filthy. He loved them because He is love. And so as we finish up this morning, when you think about discipleship, when you think about being a disciple, really easy to think that that's all about books and study and courses and conferences and prayer and getting knowledge for yourself. And it could easily seem that we've taken a pendulum swing away from last year's theme of being sent people to the world. And now we're thinking about being disciples in the church, and it's all about our own knowledge. It's like let's forget about the world for a while and concentrate ourselves for a year. Nothing could be further from the truth. We are not on a pendulum swing away from mission and towards discipleship. Jesus said, follow me. Follow me. That's discipleship. And what? I will make you fishers of men. The natural pathway of discipleship is to reach those who do not yet know the love of God. The test of discipleship is your love for the unlovely.
Because that's how you're a disciple in the first place. That's the test of discipleship. Do you love the unlovely here in this church? Outside in the world.